Yes, it's Emerging Artist Night. That's what you're getting this hour as well. Claude Swanson, our special guest tonight, as we talk about his work, Life Force, the Scientific Basis. We'll be back more as we look at scientific evidence for the paranormal, psychokinesis. That's next. Welcome back with Dr. Claude Swanson. Claude, one of my favorite areas of all this is mind over matter, psychokinesis. Tell me how much you studied it.
Well, a lot.
You're fascinated with it, too.
I absolutely. I think one of my first windows into psychokinesis was the Princeton Pear Lab work, which I'm sure you've heard a lot about. But they were very systematic. They had little devices called random event generators, REGs, that use quantum noise. And they found that their subjects, most of whom were pretty average people, were still able, with their minds, to affect these devices, make them give ones more often or zeros more often as they wanted to. And even over huge distances, it didn't matter. They were able to affect these devices. And they have lots of data over 30 years plus of testing. And they found that the odds against chance to explain their data is like trillions to one. So there's very real, very well-proven effects.
Well, that sure is. Okay, let's get into mind over matter. How do you think this works?
Well, again, it's this torsion field, which sort of makes up the nature of the random fluctuations we call random in all quantum phenomena, and it's really there at the basis of it, I believe. In fact, this is what the Russian theory says, that the torsion field can explain all of these paranormal phenomena. And very recently, we had another piece of evidence that supports this. A bunch of American scientists at Purdue, they were trying to study random event generators. They were looking at radioactive materials, which are supposed to give off random little particles of alpha particles or electrons at random periods. And they said, well, maybe that would be a good random event generator that we could study. They began studying it, and as they did, they began noticing there were some things that were happening that were not quite random, that it was correlated with solar flares on the sun.
Huh.
And this was totally surprising to them. Over several years of testing, they found out that it's the core of the sun, the inner part of the sun, where most of this influence is coming from, and there's no really good physical theory to explain it.
I was going to say, how could you?
But the bottom line appears to be that this effect is exactly what the Russians found with their torsion studies, that this background flux of the flow of these little torsion particles, which they call phytons, it's not uniform. And when it flows one way and the other, they will see changes in all physical processes that move in step with each other. And so, again, it looks like we're seeing proof that the torsion field from the sun and from the processes in the sun are causing these random event generators to behave the way they do. It's very much the same as when a person using psychokinesis is affecting a random event generator by producing their own torsion field. So I think we may have kind of rediscovered once again the importance of this torsion field that's really present in all of the processes that we take for granted, that we think we understand. If we look at them more closely, we'll find that torsion is affecting them, and we can see its effects.
What do you think about life after death?
Well, it's real as far as I can tell. I've talked to lots of people who had near-death experiences, who have been clinically dead for some period of time, up to a half hour or so. As you know, there are cases where people have been clinically dead for several days and come back, and they tell stories that are all very similar to one another. There's a lot of other ways of studying life after death with hypnosis, past life regressions, and those stories, again, we find a lot of correlations from one person to the next. There are people who have now developed devices that seem to be able to communicate with the other side to some degree. And, of course, mediums for a long time have been able to make contact. Gary Schwartz has shown that even in controlled experiments with mediums, that they can give information that where you can reduce any possibility of contact with the person they're reading and get objective evidence, and still you find that the evidence, the information is valid. So there's lots of different ways of looking at the afterlife, and they all come up with the same conclusion, that it appears to be real, that life goes on there, and you know, it's a very, very important area for us to study and understand.
When you realize that it is real, isn't it a sobering effect on people?
I find it very encouraging.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it one of the important things about it is that that there are all these rules, there are all these characteristics of life on the other side that they turned out to be really important for us. If we want to know how the world works, and we find out that that certain behaviors on the physical side lead to certain consequences on the other side, that's kind of important to know. We might want to know that. You know, Daniel Brinkley talks about the life review that he went through after his near-death experience. And, you know, you feel all the effects that you've had on other people in this lifetime. You feel it from their point of view. So we are connected with other people, and there's a kind of a balance or kind of accounting for how we have behaved. One of the really interesting experiments I came across in my research on life force is that was done by Joey Jones, a professor at University of California, Irvine, who found that energy healers can heal even cells that are damaged by radiation. In an experiment where typically half of them die after 24 hours, an energy healer can increase their lifespan of these cells so that 88% of them survive after 24 hours with the right amount of adding of energy. And he did this over a 10-year period, hundreds of repetitions. But he thought, gee, something's missing. It should be higher than 88% survival. One day the idea occurred to him, what about karma? And so the next experiment, he had one of his assistants make a credit card contribution to a charity while they were doing the healing experiment. The survival rate for these little cells went from 88% to 96%. So even the implication of a good act can have physical, measurable effects on us and on the healing process. So, you know, karma, which is of a higher dimensional aspect of our connection with this afterlife, has now been demonstrated. So I think these are all things that I'm trying to learn from. How do I live a better life so that you know, the consequences of the next life might be better?
Maybe so. Now, you're a believer in reincarnation, right?
Yeah, and it didn't start out that way. I didn't believe in it 20 years ago. I mean, I was raised, you know, I had no reason to believe any of this stuff. And in each case, I did lots of research over many years, reading, you know, dozens and hundreds of books in some cases. And so I learned hypnosis, I learned past life regression. I've had myself regressed into past life experiences, things like that. So, you know, in each case, it's a matter of trying to study it and figure out for yourself in a more skeptical way what's the truth. So, you know, belief to me is, you know, not maybe the best way to describe it, but at this point, it seems like the most likely case, yeah.
Why is it sometimes, Claude, when we have, you know, try to gather the masses together to use the conscious mind to attempt something, whether it's to manipulate weather, stop something, and sometimes it goes awry, sometimes we go too far, but how does that work?
I don't know. It's funny you should ask. I mean, one of the things I've been trying to encourage on my website is what I call a peace prayer. It's a synchronized prayer. One of the things that we've learned with consciousness experiments is that when many people think the same thought at the same time, there is a bigger effect. And another thing we've learned from research is that there are certain times of day when we are most receptive to ESP messages. Basically, that time of day turns out to be 13.5 hours sidereal, as the astronomer would say, or it's when the constellation Virgo is overhead. So we're more receptive. We pick up ESP messages more accurately during that time window. This is James Spottiswood's research. So those two things put together lead to the conclusion that if we want to affect a certain part of the world most effectively, we would pray together at just the right time when they are in that 13.5-hour sidereal time zone. For me, the Middle East seems like the most unstable and the most dangerous part of the world in terms of how its consequences could grow into something much more serious. So I've been encouraging people to pray at a certain time to try to bring about peace, alleviate tension, encourage love and forgiveness. And that's on my website. So I'm hoping that maybe one of the secrets of getting through 2012 is to learn to use some of these lessons of consciousness in a positive way. So that's my hope.
I find it fascinating that you've tied the sun into a lot of these things that are happening. Yeah, the question is how? How does the sun work in conjunction with all this?
Well, the one answer would be what I mentioned a little while ago, that we have found out that there are these effects from the sun, that processes in the sun, like the turbulence, the spinning of the core, solar flares, they all seem to produce a little deflection, little changes in the amount of torsion that's present in our neighborhood, in the neighborhood of the Earth. So we are seeing effects in the laboratory that are due to these changes in the sun, such as radioactive decay rates shifting, things like that. So when there's that kind of effect with torsion, it affects all the physical processes. So anything that's measurable, one of the things the Russians have found is that when you have a torsion process, it can be anything where there's an irreversible process, where evaporation, for example, burning, a dissolving of sugar in water. These are all processes in which something changes. Entropy changes. The Russians find that torsion of one type or the other is created. They have measured that the mass of other objects will change when the torsion field changes. So it's just one more indication that torsion underlies other physical processes and it affects everything around us, that we thought these things were fixed. We thought we understood them, but actually it turns out the torsion affects them. So it's just a really interesting and far-flung connection we have with the sun and with everything else.
Do you believe in the multiverse theory, Claude?
I do, actually. I didn't used to. I've had to learn to believe a lot of things I never used.
A lot of things have changed for you.
Well, in my first book, Synchronized Universe, I had to try to understand how it's possible for Philippine healers to put their hands through people, how it's possible for certain teleportation experiments when objects pass through other objects. In fact, my last interview on your show a couple of years ago, we had this amazing discussion because one of the predictions of this model is that parallel universes can exist. And people called in with experiences where cars had passed through other cars, where physical objects had passed through other objects. And that type of phenomenon, although it flies right in the face of Western physics, seems to happen more often than you'd ever think possible. So when I put this theory into my first book, I didn't really take it very seriously. I didn't think it'd be possible to ever verify it. And then within a year or two, I began hearing about a man named Richard Bartlett, who developed a healing technique called matrix energetics, which is based on this idea that when you have a problem, a broken bone or some illness, there is a parallel reality that you can shift to that doesn't have that illness, and you can actually heal instantly from a variety of different things. And there's a whole technique that he developed that makes that possible. For a physicist, this is hard stuff to deal with.
Oh, sure.
It means these parallel realities are real, and you can physically instantly change certain things that were measurable.
How many do you think there are?
I have no idea. Lots.
Could be many. Infinite?
Well, I don't know.
Who knows?
I think it's probably finite, but it's a lot.
I mean, if there's six, why not seven? If there's seven, why not 12?
Right. I think it's probably millions at least. That's my suspicion. In my particular model that came up in the first book, it's based on the fact that particles like electrons, for example, interact with other electrons. And at the very smallest scale, they have to be looking at each other. They have to be moving toward each other to interact. So their motions end up being synchronized for them to have an interaction and to be considered real, to be considered part of the same universe. So it makes it possible for other particles to move in a way that's not synchronized with the first set, and they would basically be invisible. They would pass right through. And that's where the idea came from. But I have been amazed with how much support I'm coming up with for this idea as time goes on.
As a physicist, how do you explain the Big Bang?
Well,
if you can.
I wasn't there. Yeah, I mean, that is the conventional model, for sure, of how the universe was created, or at least as far back in time as we can go. The problem is that the more I look at astronomy, the more open-minded I am about what some of the pieces that don't fit in the puzzle, I'm attracted to some of the maverick astronomers like Halton Harp, who has a very distinguished career as an astronomer. He was a protege of Edwin Hubble way back when, but he has noticed that a lot of the things that astronomers believe don't seem to match up too well with what he observes looking at the sky photographs and the sky measurements. For example, quasars are supposed to be these huge collections of matter at the furthest reaches of our universe, but Halton Harp notices actually, they tend to be lined up as pairs, lined up with an exploding galaxy that's in the middle. And he believes that they're created and sort of spit out from an exploding galaxy, and it's because of their Doppler shift and the fact that they were just recently created that they have this high redshift. He would say that the redshift that all astronomers use to understand the universe is flawed, that there's something else that goes on that can cause redshifts, not in our model. Therefore, the universe is probably not the age that we think it is. It's probably not the size that we think it is.
I would agree with that. Here.
So I'm just an agnostic on the Big Bang until we learn more about it.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. Claude, where do we get your new book, Life Force, The Scientific Basis?
Well, there's two easy ways. One is to go to synchronizeduniverse.com. And that's my website, www.synchronizeduniverse.com. And we spell synchronize with a Z. That's the American way, not the English way. Or just go to Amazon and put the name Claude Swanson into your search under books. Look for Claude Swanson, and it should pop up pretty easily there. It's on Amazon.
All right. Well, stay with us. Claude Swanson, our very special guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And again, his website, synchronizeduniverse.com, is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And if you go to our website, make it one of your favorites so you don't have to type it in all the time. Go to our website, just simply, you know, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You'll find those icons up in the right-hand corner. Indeed, indeed. Next hour, we're going to take your phone calls with Dr. Claude Swanson. When we come back, what about the Russian experiments and time travel? Get ready for that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with physicist Claude Swanson. Claude, let's talk about some of the Russian experiments, time travel, everything they've been doing. Are they light years ahead of us?
Well, they might be, George. It's hard to know because I think in this country, I suspect we have, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars we spend on black programs. And we have no idea what goes on in those programs. We have a little hints occasionally. There's a wonderful YouTube interview by David Sirota with a scientist named Boyd Bushman, who worked for Hughes Aircraft and things like that. And based upon some of the things that come out, it's possible we've been doing some of the same things, but we don't hear about it. In the case of the Russians, we're kind of lucky because they went through a very special time in the early 90s called Glasnost and Perestroika, when they released their client states. The Soviet Union kind of fell apart, and a lot of these scientists working in secret programs found themselves without funding. A lot of the labs closed, and they released their security restrictions on a lot of these things. And so these papers on torsion came out during that time period. So we may be very lucky that we got a little glimpse through a window of what they were doing then, and now we know about it. Now, it's quite possible that they really are ahead of us or were ahead of us then, but if we have something like it, we don't hear about it in this country.
How successful were they on some of these time travel experiments?
Well, what I know about, there's a scientist named Chernobrov who used these Russian torsion generators. Basically, there's two kinds of torsion. There's a left and right-handed...
And explain torsion.
Okay. Well, torsion is the Russian name for basically a twisting of space. In the old Einstein model 100 years ago, when he developed our model of gravity, he left out the possibility that space could have a twist. What the Russians have done is explore the consequences of that twist. They found that every elementary particle, like electrons, protons, neutrons, they all have a spin. They spin like little tops. When that spin flips or changes direction, it creates a little torsion wave, which they often call a photon. It's like a little elementary twist of space, an elementary torsion wave. It turns out there's two kinds of these waves. One speeds up time, one slows down time. Normally, in our normal space-time, time passes at a certain rate that we're all used to. It's because there's a balance between these two types of torsion, one slightly more than the other, and the difference giving us our rate of time. What the Russians have done is say, okay, we'll make a generator that makes more of one type of torsion or the other, and by doing that, they change the balance from what it normally is. They can make time travel faster or time pass more slowly, and they build little chambers as big as a meter or two in diameter, and outside of it, like little quills on a porcupine, they'll have these torsion generators sticking out, and they'll be pumping torsion waves of one type or the other into the center of the chamber. So it'll build up a concentration of either right-handed or left-handed torsion that's different from what we have in our normal space-time. And they find that inside that chamber, time passes at a different rate. You put a clock in there, a wristwatch, or some physical process like an atom or something, and they find it changes its rate of time. They've put animals in there, and I imagine people, depending on how big the chamber is, they initially found problems when they put animals in because the chamber was not sufficiently uniform. If the leg was had a different time rate than the arm or the head, they would have severe physical problems. They claim to have been able to work out that and successfully put animals into this time chamber where time is passing either more slowly or more rapidly than it is in the outside world. So that's the level that I have seen of what they've been able to accomplish. However, you can imagine that this could go, you know, far beyond that in terms of its implications.
Oh, absolutely. Do you think one day we really will be able to travel into time, much like the old movie, The Time Machine?
You know, yes, I do. And I didn't used to. And I think one of the problems in thinking about this is the grandfather paradox. You know, you go back in time,
see him,
your grandfather, and then that should erase your existence, you know, and makes a contradiction. So that should make it impossible to be able to do that. I used to believe that, but I've come to believe now that we have these parallel realities, these parallel physical systems that differ from one from the other by only a slight frequency or a slight phase. If those exist, then it's possible to go back in time, make some change, and then come back in a parallel reality where you might not even notice the difference. So parallel universes actually make it possible to travel in time without encountering some of these contradictions or paradoxes. So it would not surprise me.
That would be dramatic if we're able to do that.
Yeah, certainly would.
Would you go if they said, hey, come on, we're going to do an experiment here and send
why not?
Somewhere. What do you think will be easier, going back into time or going forward?
The Russians have been finding with their time machine experiments that it's very different to going backwards and going forwards. Because of the things are not determined when you go in the forward direction versus the backward direction. So they actually see physical differences in going the two different directions. But I guess backward, but I don't really know. You're out of my area of expertise here. But I think it'd be fun to try. You know, the other part of this whole thing is remote viewing, because with remote viewers, our consciousness apparently is able to look forward and backward in time. Joe McMonagle, one of the greatest remote viewers in America, says that he is about 65 to 80% accuracy in both future and past targets. So even though there is some flexibility in terms of going into the future, you know, it must be possible to some extent.
Well, I think so, too. I really do. Let's talk a little bit about haunted houses. You did some research there involving some scientific measurements. What were they? What did they show?
Well, this was back around the year 2000, and I had a bunch of friends, all of whom had a lot of anomalous experiences, and we were concerned about Y2K and instabilities, things like that, whatever might be happening. So they wanted to have a farmhouse to get out of the city of Washington, D.C., out into the country. And but my friends, given that their predilection with strange experiences, they picked the most haunted farmhouse anybody has ever seen. It was just across the border in West Virginia. We had balls of light outside that were frequently photographed. There were four or five different spirits in the house that people saw. I never saw them, but I did feel very cold, you know, cold, intense cold spots that were associated with them. People would report Bigfoot sightings. One woman was there over the weekend when it snowed. She got up in the morning, walked outside, and saw these giant footprints in the snow around the house. All kinds of strange things. What we were primarily trying to do is make measurements of what we saw. And we did see some infrared effects and some magnetic effects, but I can't say we have, and some photographs. We have some photographs of some vortexes and some orbs that were pretty dramatic, but that was the extent of it.
You know, so with the work that you've been doing recently and how much you've changed over the years, do you think back when other days that you were in college, you know, as a physicist, learning how dramatic you have changed?
Yes.
It's huge.
Well, it's so funny because when you're in school, you know, there's a program. You're given the courses. You go into the lab. You do the experiments. The experiments verify what you learned in school, the theory. And you come away believing this is the truth, and I have firsthand proof that this is the truth. This is the way the universe works. And so there's a lot of you have overconfidence is a mild way of putting it, that this is that you understand things. You think you do. And the first time something happens, like in my case with remote viewing, where you hear about events that you know have to be true based on where they're coming from, and yet they violate all of this confidence you have in your education, the mind just kind of freezes up. It just boggles, and you don't know what to do with it. You have two things that are impossible to believe at the same time. So I have a lot of sympathy for scientists who are trying to, you know, to deal with some of these new ideas, or just basically the normal response is just reject them, because then you can sleep at night. You won't be worrying about things. But, you know, it's just a much bigger, more rich, more interesting universe than I ever thought in those days. So I'm really happy that these things did come to me, that I came across these things. But you know, there's so many belief systems, there's so many cultures that believe in spirits, they have a belief in energy healing, they believe in things that in the West we've always tended to just poo-poo and just reject and say it's impossible. And therefore, those are just primitive, ignorant societies, and that allows us to sleep at night and not have to face the contradictions. But when we do open our minds to ask, maybe, what if they're real, you know, then it changes everything, and our whole worldview enlarges as a result.
On Fridays, we have a prayer session where collectively people will pray for people whose families have written in, and I've created this unpublished list of things. You know, Joe Blow with his ailment, and people pray for them. It works.
Yep.
I'm telling you, it works.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
How? Why?
Well, I hope you'll forgive me for sounding like a broken record, but in my view, it's this torsion field that our minds and our spirits help to shape and control, so that when we send out a thought, we are contributing our own little changes, our own little part of this torsion field, and therefore changing the background conditions, which makes it more likely for healing. That's my scientific, take on things, as best I understand it.
Well, maybe so. When you were putting together your work, Life Force, what did you find to be the most fascinating?
Well, I think it would be a toss-up. I think the Russian research was probably the most exciting, because it pulled together so many threads from other prior research. It explained the Chinese energy, the Qigong healing and things like that. It explained the work that was done by von Reichenbach in Germany, where he used sensitives who could see this energy in the dark. Lots of different people who have studied this over the years, and they pulled it all together. So I would probably say that. However, I loved my time in England with the crop circles and with the sacred sites, because you can feel the energy there. So to me, being able to pull that in with the same, with the torsion work, also felt pretty good.
As a physicist, would you go through this again to be a pure physicist if you didn't know what you know now about all these other aspects?
Would I do it all over?
Yeah, would you still want to be a physicist? Just a pure physicist?
Well, what do you mean by pure?
Well, not knowing about the paranormal, not knowing about all these various aspects of remote viewing and telekinesis and hands-on healing or long-distance healing. What if you were just a plain old physicist again?
Well,
I mean, your life's changed, your attitude's changed about all this, but what if you didn't know this?
I think it depends. If you want the truth, if you really want to know how things work at the deepest level, then I think I would probably follow the same path. You know, every time you come across something that doesn't fit, you have to examine it.
I mean, at what point, at what year in your career, how long ago, did you make this flip?
Well, the mid-80s was when I discovered remote viewing. So that was my first major...
All right, so how many years would you have been a physicist up until then?
Well, about 10 years.
10 years. So did you feel cheated when you started learning these other aspects that science would poo-poo? Did you feel cheated? You know, you went through, you got your degrees, I mean, your PhD.
Did I want a refund?
Yeah.
Well, it's really funny, because all through the earlier years, before I began learning about these strange phenomena, I was still obsessed with this idea that there was some kind of particle that connected things over huge distances,
mm-hmm.
connected the motions of local particles with the distant matter of the universe. I was always trying to figure that out, as though some half-remembered idea that I was trying to puzzle out about how that would work. had no support from the physics community. Nobody else seemed to be interested in that particular idea, but that was what I was, you know, saddled with. And so that was one of the reasons that it had such an impact on me when I began learning about remote viewing, because it's consistent with this concept of these particles that connect things locally with things far away.
Well, it is pretty dramatic, isn't it?
It's very satisfying. Suddenly the whole picture makes a lot more sense.
Have you used some of this in your own personal life?
Well, I meditate on and off,
yeah,
not as much as I should. I have used, it certainly helps when we create images of what we want to happen or what we want to achieve. That whole idea of using mental focus and mental patterning, that does work, and I do try to use that to some extent.
I've got David Wilcock coming on this coming week, Claude, also, so we'll talk about many of these other aspects that he's done some work in. And it really is. It is mind-blowing for me that all these events I will go to throughout the year, how many people have dedicated their lives to trying to unravel these mysteries.
Well, the first time I ever met David, he and I were speaking at the same conference years ago, and some of our slides were identical. And they were both all about the Russian torsion work. So anyways, it is interesting.
It sure is. What do you think of the pyramids in Egypt?
They are wonderful. I've spent 2 weeks there years ago. I spent a night by myself in the Great Pyramid from 11 p.m. until 1 a.m.
Anything strange happen?
Well, yeah, I was a chicken. I have to say, I was a chicken.
You left?
No, I didn't leave. No. I paid quite a bit of money to
stay there.
So I was not going to walk out. But I had read Paul Brunton's account of when he'd gone there decades before. He'd been there all night, and around midnight or so, these spirits showed up that were quite frightening to him. And then around dawn, other more beatific and benevolent spirits showed up. He went through this real initiation process.
Did you see spirits?
Well, the problem is that I kind of want to get to that stage, but there's a part of me that's afraid. So I lay in the sarcophagus for about an hour.
Let's let you pick up that story right from there.